I'm Nancy Winder. I'm a pastor in Seattle, and the title of this session is Vera Brittain, Testament to Hope. And first, how many of you ever heard of Vera Brittain? Has anybody? Testament of Youth, her the first book of the three I'm going to talk about, was a masterpiece theater presentation on public television in the fall of 1980. And anybody see that? That's one reason I'm doing a session on Vera Brittain. First, I'm going to tell you what I'm not. You should know this before we start. I'm not an historian. I'm no expert on either the history of World War I or World War II, or what's gone on, or any of these things. I'm simply a rather eclectic reader, or maybe a better word would be an accidental reader. And I tend to believe the recommendations of people who I have a high regard for. And Mary Hinderly recommended Testament of Youth to me about a year and a half ago, just before the Masterpiece Theater thing. She had read all these books as they came out. And one thing fun about being an accidental reader is that you accidentally hit upon things that are deeply moving and terribly profound and happen to touch very well the situation you're in yourself. And Vera Brittain, who lived maybe from 1896 to 1970, maybe 1893, 4 or 5. Nobody's sure exactly when she was born, and she never was either. It's back in the days when all you wrote down was your approximate age and who your parents were or who you were married to, and it didn't really matter how old women were when they were born. they think she was born in 1896, or her family does. One thing that is especially remarkable about Vera Brittain and what these three books cover, Testament of Youth, Testament of Friendship, and Testament of Experience. I've got them right here. Testament of Youth is basically about World War I. Testament of Friendship is about the period between the wars. Testament of Experience is about World War II. And the books are themselves, they're not really autobiography, although she writes from her own experience. They'd be more likely to be called personal documentary. That is, she is documenting the time she lived through from her own personal viewpoint. And for that reason, they are remarkable. These books, as I said, have deeply moved and touched me and have met me in places I've been in my life and currently am in. And if any of you have ever experienced a great loss of someone you love dearly, these books are for you. If any of you are women who have struggled to make your way in a profession or simply to find yourself in whatever historical situation you're in, these books are for you. If any of you are simply people who try, as I'm sure we all do, to live our lives as they're given to us as best we can, and to make the most also of our calling and commitment as Christians, these books are for you. There's something in there for everyone, and the wonder of them is that this isn't some writer making an attempt to explain away historical circumstances, as historians are often wont to do. This happened because, and this happened because, and the result of that was. They're not really an attempt even to lay out specific facts, as an historian would, but rather from the wealth of experience of this one woman to try and wrestle with those things which happened to her. Now, I think these books are important for another reason. Now, none of you have ever heard of Vera Brittain, and some of you, I think, are old enough to remember well at least World War II. And a lot of the things we often hear about both the world wars in our time come from, or what the people we remember reading about or whatever are very eminent people. You know, they were the people who were in the governments that were involved. Or they're the famous historians who gather all the data and get it all together. But Vera Brittain is just, she was an educated woman and a writer by profession, but a simple middle-class English woman talking about her experience in these terrible, terribly devastating times in England. And I think for that they have particular merit. Because here we can meet someone who's like us, and who talks about these situations in the same way we would tell our own story. Granted, she's a writer and real good with words and might be able to do it a little more clearly and a little more articulately and a little more gracefully than some of us. But the fact that she is indeed one of us makes them very special. Now, when I was working on this session, I was real sorry that this, in some ways, that I should have asked Charlie to switch this in the middle of the week or something, because this is the session that I'm the most apprehensive about of all the ones I'm doing all week. And the reason is, it's real hard to know. I mean, right here we have, folks, 1,800 pages of material. And I don't want that to shy you away from reading them either. They go very, very quickly. And they're just so completely absorbing. Testament of Youth is available in the bookstore, and it's also in the library. And the others are all readily available in bookstores, all three of them. But let me tell you a little more about Vera Brittain and her life. She came, I said, from middle class. Her father owned a textile factory in the west of England. She, in her life, she was a graduate of Somerville College in Oxford. She was both a feminist and a pacifist, and both of those not by any great intellectual stimulation that caused her to go out and say, I'm going to support this cause, but both of those stands were taken out of her own experience that literally drove her to it. As a feminist, because she had to struggle with her parents in order to go to college. Her father said, well, your brother can go, but there's no reason why any woman should go to college. And this was still in the early 20th century when, in England, women were being educated at Oxford, but they were not being granted degrees. Degrees were not granted. Women's education in Oxford began in the late 1880s. The first degrees were not conferred until 1920. So all those women that had earned their degrees up till then were not granted their degrees until 1920. And Cambridge didn't even come around to letting women in until about 1930. So the real high echelons of education were not really open to women. She finally was convinced her father to be able to go, but World War I interrupted her education. I'll get back to that in a little bit and talk more about her experience in World War I. As she did become an author and write, she did finally graduate to and get her degree, and she wrote 29 books. Some of them novels. Her novels aren't that great. You can find them in your local library. They tend to be a bit too didactic. She's always trying to make a point with her novels, which doesn't make a good novel. but they're interesting for what they are. A lot of essays. She was very, very involved in peace causes and in feminist causes, but not exactly in the ways that we would think about that in our own time, I guess. Some of us tend to be a little shy of people who we call radical feminists or radical pacifists. Vera Brittain was not at all radical. I'll repeat that. As I said, her work for the cause of women and her work for the cause of peace came directly from her own experience and indeed was necessitated by her own experience. As you read through these books, you'll see that there was no other way that Vera Brittain could function. These books are real depressing. You should know that to begin with. In Testament of Youth, Vera Brittain recounts her experience in World War I, and she talks about, one, her sheltered existence as a young woman of the middle class in England. She talks about her very great and wonderful relationship with her brother. Through her brother at his school, she meets a young man named Roland Layton, who she falls in love with and becomes engaged to. And plus her brother's friends, there are two other friends, the five of them make up a nice, very close group of comrades. And in World War I, Vera's brother, her fiancé, and both the other friends are all killed. And the whole book deals with her trying to maintain this loss. And it's so well written, I just reread Testament of Youth just before coming up here. And when Roland Layton dies, her fiancé, right up to the moment when the telegram comes, you know exactly what's going to happen. It isn't going to disturb it at all for me to tell you that happens. You know, and even right up to the moment that it happens, I found myself still saying, no, he's not going to die, he's not going to die, he's not going to die. But he does. during World War I, she struggles with the issue of the war itself. She deals with the overwhelming patriotism in England at that time, and what that did to the young men. There's one place where she talks about She goes to, just when Edward and Roland are graduating from their public school, Uppingham, and she talks about the awards list. Roland Layton was a quite up-and-coming young man. She looked at the program and she said, Nettleship Prize for English essay, Ari Layton. Holden Prize, how do you like that? For Latin prose, Ari Layton. Greek prose composition, Ari Layton. Latin hexameters, Ari Layton. Greek epigram, Ari Layton. Captain in classics, Ari Layton. He won all but one prize. And then she went to the graduation exercise, as they call the speech day. And she says, this is what the headmaster said. She says, I do not recall much of the speech, which ended with a list of the precepts laid down for boys by a famous Japanese general, a monument of civilization whose name I forget, but whose qualities were evidently considered entirely suitable for emulation by young English gentlemen. I shall always, however, remember the final prophetic precept and the breath of silence which followed the headmaster's slow religious emphasis upon the words. This is in 1914, July of 1914. You know, World War I really began on August 4th, 1914, so it's just a month before the onset of World War I. It says, if a man cannot be useful to his country, he is better dead. And it was with those words that Edward and Roland and their friends were released from their public school education. And with that same sense of patriotism went with all the other young men in England to fight this terrible war. And most of you know some of the history of World War I, know that England lost something like two-thirds of its young men between the ages of 18 and 30. these were gone. Roland Layton himself had he had an eyesight problem. And it took him, he went through about 18 different regiments before he finally found one that would take him. Because he refused to stay at home and go to Oxford because the call of patriotism was too strong. And as you go through Testament Youth, the letters between Roland and Vera are terrific. And to see the way that they develop as they go on, the young men go out to fight. And Vera supporting them and everyone else saying, yes, this is the thing to do. We have to fight this war. We have to deal with the great German enemy. We have to take care of this. And all the wonderful, wonderful speeches and words said about the glory of war and the wonders of being a soldier and great acts of courage and heroism that they were all going to face, and were going to face it with their teeth clenched and everything in order. And it was all very carefully reasoned out. And it was all a very heavily emotional thing as well. But as their letters get going, and after Roland and Edward get out in the trenches and start seeing precisely what is happening and start writing back to Vera, and after Vera and the other women who are left at home start realizing the impact of the loss of the men on their lives and what happens, their attitudes begin to change very quickly. At the beginning of Testament of Youth, Vera Brittain says, the worst thing she thought about World War I at the beginning, the worst part about it, was that it was a terrible interruption in her personal life. That was the worst thing about it. Her personal life had been interrupted. She could no longer go to Oxford. She could, as she'd planned and had fought for so long. The two men that were closest to her in the world had to go away, and she was bereft of their companionship. Not just the fact that they were going to war, but that she didn't have them around. And she rings the changes on that throughout the book, and how she sees the whole pettiness of in a sense, of the kind of pettiness that the patriotism that was in all of them caused towards the great brutalities of war. She says at one point that one thing that impressed her in retrospect, she wrote this book was published in 1933, so she'd had some 12, 15 years to think about this stuff. And she said that one thing that impressed her so much about the kind of patriotic fervor, and in many places she says there's nothing wrong with loving your country, but it's the manner in what that causes you to do. And she said, points out how security conscious the middle class of England were, and that sending their boys to war was a way of protecting the status quo, which they were going to do at all costs. And the young men that went out felt the same way. And I thought how clearly reflective that is also of us in our time. and the many kinds of actions we take right now in all the countries of the West, a real desire for security and for protecting the status quo. I'd like to read a few things. Here's one thing that they found in the war was they get all riled up to go out and fight the great German enemy, and then they get out there, and, you know, they're just other people like me. And she makes the point time and time again, as we all know, World War I is the last war of hand-to-hand combat, where men actually saw the other men they were fighting. We actually got, you know, you saw the person you killed, and that kind of thing. And she was, Vera Brittain became a VAD, Voluntary Aid Deputies. They were sort of assistant nurses, and she goes through this whole routine too about they were trained to do all this stuff, and then they'd get into these hospitals, and the really trained nurses, I mean, it was bad enough trying to fight being a woman in a man's world, but then trying to also fight the trained nurses, and the VADs would get into the hospitals, and the trained nurses at that point were also trying to fight for some dignity for their profession, and so they couldn't stand these young whippersnapper girls who had barely no training coming in, and they wouldn't really let them do any nursing to begin with until it just got so heavy they had to let them. But then the minute they got out of a field hospital back to London, even like Vera Brittain she spent a year in Malta and 2 years in France, you know, just nursing under these horrendous conditions, got back to a London hospital, and she was washing bedpans again, you know, because the trained nurses were not about to let any of these women sneak in on their territory. So there was a battle of women against women, as well as women. It was really chaotic. And the other thing about the women in the war was that all of a sudden they were needed. You know, they needed the women to do all kinds of jobs that women had not done before. And so they went out and did them. The minute the war was over, Parliament spent 5 years passing all kinds of resolutions to disallow the women doing all the things they were doing during the war. You know, it's sort of an attempt, she says, to obliterate any memory of the war. See, women working in jobs that they shouldn't work in would only continually remind people of the great bloodshed of the war and all the loss it had. So you try and obliterate that by trying to go back to what was before, but after the war was over, you couldn't do that. But here's something that, while she was nursing in one hospital, she was talking, she said, on my first day at the hospital, a Scottish sergeant produced a comment of which the stark truth came finally home to me 3 summers afterwards, and that's when her brother died. We shall beat them, he said, but they'll break our hearts first. And then she goes on to talk about what the men learned when they were out dealing with the enemy face to face. This same man told me a story, later guaranteed as true by Roland, which once again convinced me the futility of war between men who, as I was beginning to realize, even amid the bloodthirsty armchair patriotism so rampant in England just then, bore no grudge against one another. Once, he said, when they were opposite the Saxons near Ypres, they said, they and the enemy made a mutual agreement not to shoot one another. In order to appear active, they continued to use their rifles but fired into the air. Occasionally they met and talked in the space between the trenches. When finally the Saxons had to change places with the Prussian guards, they promised to fire a volley as warning. This promise they faithfully observed. I mean, here's the English on one side and the Germans on the other side, the Saxons, and neither one of them wants to shoot the other one, so in order to prove to their commanders, who are 3 hills away or whatever, they shoot shots in the air and even protect themselves by warning that they're changing the guard. You know, and maybe it's too bad that more regiments didn't come to those kinds of agreements, or the war could have been real quick and there would have been a lot less... a lot less bloodshed. At one point, she wrote a poem, this is after Roland died, about May morning when she and Roland had been walking and they were in love and all this good stuff. And then she goes that it's May again and he's dead and all kinds of things. I don't read the whole thing. And the last stanza goes like this. Often I wonder as I grieve in vain if when the long, long future years creep slow and war and tears alike have ceased to reign, I ever shall recapture once again the mood of that May morning long ago. And then she writes, the concluding speculation is answered now. not only for me, but for all my generation. We never have recaptured that mood, and we never shall. And that's the point of the entire book, that World War I completely shattered the whole world, once and for all. Completely broke an entire way of civilized life. Completely altered patterns of family and work and economy, of relationships between nations and even relationships between people. Through all these books, she continually talks about how the scars of the loss of her brother, fiancé, and their friends marked her life forever. She did marry, and when she married, one thing was clear between her and her husband, although they had a wonderful relationship, and I'll tell you more about that later, but she said, she said to him, basically, I want to marry you, but I marry you with the scars of these old loves. That loss is part of who I am, and I can never give to you the same kind of fullness of affection that I was able to give to Roland and my brother. And not so much that her affection isn't really a matter of degree. It's a matter of what scars do. You know, they cover over and block up. And as I said, for any of you who have suffered losses like that, how she talks about all that through all three of these books is truly remarkable. She has this to say about war at one point. The ironies of war, I reflected sadly, were more than strange. In terms of a rational universe, they were quite inexplicable. But now the universe had become irrational, and nothing was turning out as it seemed to have been ordained. And she has this comment about what happened to the women who were left back in England during all this. She says, this is the one time when she was in Malta, her mother became ill, and she was called to come home, and that meant she had to break her contract as a VAD, which was something you just didn't do. But her mother insisted she come home, and there was always this battle against the women who had gone to work and that their place was really back at home, either with their parents or their children or whatever it was. And when she got home, she found that her mother really wasn't quite as sick as it sounded like she was, and she got mad. And, sounds like any mother and daughter situation of any time. and so she talks about the problems of the women in wartime. The men had no conflicting obligations. It was the obligation of every able-bodied man to go to war. That was very clear, and they didn't flinch at that. And the ones that weren't able-bodied had home jobs that were equally as important. And she said the conflict came for the women as to whether or not they actually went to war with the men and helped out there or stayed home and did that. Once again, talking about the great break that this war made and what everything that had gone before. And so she says this about what had happened to women because of those conflicting obligations. She says, what exhausts women in wartime is not the strenuous and unfamiliar tasks that fall upon them, nor even the hourly dread of death for husbands or lovers or brothers or sons. It is the incessant conflict between personal and national claims which wears out their energy and breaks their spirit. And so not only were all the men killed, but all the women were exhausted and left England in no place. One thing these books are good for me, I realize this is a bit disjointed, and if you're not following me, please, I like to be interrupted, I don't mind, but are good for me is, I was born after World War II, but for all of us who lived in the United States and Canada, we do not know war within our borders. No one living in the 20th century knows that. We have no idea what it's like to be in a war-torn country. Some people do know the horrors of war and loss, because some of you probably had good friends and family members and whatever who were killed during World War II or in the Korean conflict or in Vietnam. But we do not know what war does to the interior of a country, to the inner fabric. We learned something in the Vietnam protest probably, in that whole situation, about what a country going to war one way or the other can do to the moral fabric and fiber of a people. But yet we don't know anything about the actual horrors of living in war. Some of you that live in Vancouver for example, you know some of the German refugees from post-World War II who were in the Lutheran churches there, probably. And so you've heard some of the stories. You know, and it's good to talk to those people and to find out what it is, and especially now when we're faced with the whole nuclear thing and the wars in the Middle East and everything else, we need to have a good grasp, I think, as horrifying as it is, of what, as well as we can get it, of what war actually does to people. Yeah.
We live in Puyallup.
Yeah.
We have fairgrounds there, and we have many Japanese people who live in that area, and we can believe when the Japanese people that we knew, people on the farms and all around, were just put in fairgrounds there, and there they had to stay, just mm-hmm. like prisoners. And they were just as shocked as anybody else. They really were Americans.
Yeah.
Just like we are.
Yeah. So you people, you knew about, you know, you were close to that and could see that happening.
It's horrifying.
And yeah,
it happened overnight to a group of people.
Yeah. Throughout Testament of You, she also talks about some of the, and goes on, and some of the things that she was getting into, getting involved with some of the, there was a peace movement that began in England, a disarmament movement that began towards the end of World War I, when it was, the war was becoming so devastating that the horror of it was increasing by the minute. And also being involved in some of the women's issues, and some of that's a little humorous. And this is some of, as I mentioned, the post-World War I stuff, where Parliament tried to pass all these laws for 5 years to do away with everything that went on. And her friend Winifred Holtby, who she met at Oxford, and who, this book is about Winifred Holtby, their friendship, and they joined a political club called the National Liberal Club, that had been all men, and they had recently let women in, and they found out they'd go to the meetings, and then they'd try and stand up and talk and just get shot down. So they finally quit, and she said they sent a nice letter to the leader of the club saying, you know, what they thought was wrong and why they were quitting and things, and of course nothing changed. And she wrote this comment about that, which I think is good. She says, in those days, we were still naive to believe that suggestions need only be bright in order to be enthusiastically accepted. And had still to learn that in clubs and societies, as in foreign offices, the one thing that really terrifies officials is the prospect of any alteration in the status quo. That's a really astute comment, and how true that is for in a lot of things now, too. One other thing, Vera Brittain, at the end of the war, became very involved with the League of Nations, and a group called the League of Nations Union, which was a group of supporters for the League of Nations. And they were convinced, as was much of the world at that time, that the League of Nations was the way to go, and that that would prevent the same kind of war from happening again. And Vera Brittain and her friend Winifred Holtby were on the lecture circuit then, and Vera Brittain was a very small woman, very slight. Until she was about 40, she was mistaken for 15 and all these things. And she talks about going to all these speaking engagements, you know, and the League of Nations Union would send out the speaker, and nobody would see her, and she'd come to the get on the train and get off the train and meet the person, and she said, I'm Vera Brittain, and they go, you're our speaker? You know, but she proved to be a very effective speaker, although she had a very quiet voice and everything like that. And so they did a great deal of that and worked for the League of Nations. One other thing that's interesting in these books is sort of Vera Brittain's, as I say, there's a little bit of everything here, her own journey of faith. World War I pretty much took away any belief in God that she had at all. Just zip. She said no God could ever allow what has happened to happen. And just before she married, she had a dream that Roland Layton was not really dead. That was her fiancé that died. Was not really dead. But he had, he had just been lost and had a memory loss and was gone, and he was back. And his family had invited her over to see him, and she found him completely and utterly changed, but not towards her. He was a completely different person, but he still wanted to marry her and be with her, you know. And so here she was faced with this terrible decision in her dream as to whether she was to marry Roland Layton, the great love of her youth, or to marry the man that she was planning to marry. And in her dream, A piece of scripture came to her mind. She said, well, when she woke up, she said, so sharp was the anguish of the decision to be made that I woke up quite suddenly with the words of a familiar text sounding as clearly in my head as though someone had spoken them close beside me. And whose shall she be at the resurrection? And then she says this. And then I remembered with a startling sense of relief that there was no resurrection to complicate the changing relationships forced upon men and women by the sheer passage of earthly time. There was only a brief interval between darkness and darkness in which to fulfill obligations, both to individuals and society, which could not be postponed to the comfortable futurity of a compensating heaven. And that's about where her faith stood at that point. But there's something really important in that, as she says, that about this brief interval between darkness and darkness, in which to fulfill obligations both to individuals and society, which could not be postponed to the comfortable futurity of a compensating heaven. And I think that that's a word that comes to Christians as well. The obligations to individuals and society that we're called upon to undertake are great indeed. And sometimes it's really easy to make theological excuses not to do those. And although Vera Brittain had abandoned any theological enterprise, she, in the midst of all this, and thank goodness to a good English education which pounds scripture into her head, comes up with a good sense of responsibility for us. I want to tell you a little bit, like I said, I'm just going to testament of friendship here a little bit. Her friend Winifred Holtby was also an author, and her books are, she wrote novels and really quite, her most famous novel is a novel called South Riding, which is about life on a Yorkshire farm. Winifred Holtby also died. She died at the age of 37 of a kidney disease. So Vera Brittain not only lost all this, but she lost also then her the best friend that she made in Oxford. They lived together, they worked together, they lectured for the League of Nations, they read each other's work. And one thing Testament of Friendship does in terms of women's issues, it talks about the friendship between a woman and a woman, which often one doesn't hear about. Throughout history, men have always told women that they don't have the same kinds of uplifting, sustaining, and encouraging friendships that men do. And part of that is that women's friendships often haven't happened in the public sphere, as have men. I mean, probably if we think, all of us, for just a few minutes, we could probably each come up with at least about three different friendships between men that are, what happened?
There's a mouse right here.
Oh, there's a mouse, yeah. Oh, he's going to try and he was running around before, too. Well, they finally backed
him up. Find his way out.
They finally backed him up the popcorn, but I think he's probably still living
he's
in hope.
Trapped in there. He's been here all morning.
Oh, he's
there. Where'd he go?
Right there.
Give me a little mouse. Mousy, mousy.
He's right here.
He's so cute.
I'll never catch him.
That's okay. Anyway, we'll go on. Between mouse and man, or whatever. He could, but going all the way back from David and Solomon to whatever you have, to some of the great relationships between some of the Greek and Roman gods and all that kind of stuff. But friendships between women and women aren't lauded and exalted the way those are. And one thing that's wonderful about this book is it really shows that friendship itself, whatever, whoever it happens to be between, whether it's between woman and woman, man and man and woman, whatever it is one of the most ennobling things that happens to human beings. There's the kind of encouragement and care and protection that comes in having good friends, or especially one good friend, is just one of life's highest treasures. And they did a lot of stuff together. One thing that's interesting about Winifred Holtby is she spent, well, go back a little bit, in the women's movement in England, the women's suffrage movement, you may have heard of the Pankhursts and all these people who were in the women's suffrage movement and all the hoo-ha that went on with that. But one of the leading lights of that was not actually an English woman. Well, she was by, no, she wasn't. She was German by birth, I guess. Named Olive Schreiner, who was a South African woman, who wrote two books that were very, very important to the women's movement. One was called Women in Labor, written in about 1890, And one is called Life on a South African Farm, which was written about 1895. And both of these books were just terrifically important to the women's suffrage testimony of youth, women's movement in England. And were, here's a quote from Women in Labor by Olive Schreiner. She says in there, "We take all labor for our province." And this is written in 1890, so this is a long time ago. "From the judge's seat to the legislator's chair, from the statesman's closet to the merchant's office, from the chemist's laboratory to the astronomer's tower, there is no post or form of toil for which it is not our intention to attempt to fit ourselves. And there is no closed door we do not intend to force open. And there is no fruit in the garden of knowledge it is not our determination to eat." Yeah, powerful stuff. And that was the food that fed many of the women who were important in the women's suffrage movement in England. And Winifred Holby was moved by Olive Schreiner's, not Women in Labor both, but also by Life on a South African Farm, that she spent 5-6 years of her life really getting to know South Africa and visiting there and doing things. And one thing, this is a little bit about her, she went there as a lecturer from the League of Nations Union to talk about the League of Nations. And because she was from the League of Nations, the South African government could not bar her from going anywhere and talking to anyone. So she, as a white person, was free to talk with people of color in South Africa, which she did. And but she had to shut up about it at the same time. And she wrote this to, Vera Brittain writes this. She had made a resolution. Winifred Holby was a bit impetuous, and somebody would ask her a question, and she'd answer it. And she made a resolution that she's going to be real careful in South Africa because she wanted to be able to observe and be there and talk and see the people and do everything without getting booted out for saying the wrong thing. And so she said anything. And she said, Brittain writes this, "Already the Yorkshire resolution, tacitly taken when she was scolded by her fellow traveler after leaving Tenerife, see all, hear all, say not, had been violated by the question which confronted her at the end of every lecture and the beginning of every party. Everywhere she went in South Africa, somebody said, 'And what do you think of South Africa?' At first, it had disconcerted her, for how was she to keep her vowed silence? How avoid expressing those uninformed opinions which her fellow passenger had scornfully assured her that she would broadcast, if, like the enchanted princess in fairy tale, she was to be trapped at any moment into speech? But after a day or two, she had realized that the question was almost mechanical, a part of the ritual of South Africa greeting, and she had chosen a harmless formula in reply. 'I think the climate is perfectly delightful.'" But she spent a great deal of time talking, when she got back to England, and through the League of Nations Union, working with the people in South Africa who were mainly the Christian missionaries and a few other intellectuals, in trying to have the English government and League of Nations start beginning to put pressure on the South African government to do away with apartheid and the color barriers and things. And so that was one part of Winifred Holtby's life. Winifred Holtby's written a very interesting book that's still in print, just called Women. Sort of about the history of women in the world. It's short and it's good. I recommend that to you. Holtby, Holtby. She was an editor of Time and Tide, which is a magazine in England in the interwar period, which you maybe have heard of. But when she wrote a book called Women in a Changing Civilization, which is the same book I was just talking about, in the American edition, it's simply called Women. And she said, it says this, which I think this is just a great comment about the women's movement in England. Winifred dedicated her book to two of those veteran campaigners, Dame Ethel Smyth and Cicely Hamilton. You may have heard of Dame Ethel Smyth. She's a fairly famous composer and a conductor in England, who did more than write The March of Women, which is something, everybody has that Judy Collins record, Bread and Roses, it's on there. The idea of inscribing a book to them had come to her in 1930 when we went to Westminster with Cicely Hamilton to see Stanley Baldwin unveil the statue of Mrs. Pankhurst in Victoria Tower Gardens. That morning's pièce de résistance had undoubtedly been not Mr. Baldwin, but Dame Ethel Smyth in the gray and scarlet robes of a doctor of music, conducting the band of the Metropolitan Police Force in her own rendering of the March of Women written to Cicely Hamilton's words. At least half the audience in the crowded enclosure remembered that Dame Ethel, on one of the many occasions that the police arrested her, had first conducted the march with a toothbrush from a window of the Holloway Jail. I love that. See this woman out there doing, sing, girls! Yeah, it was good. This is Testament of Friendship, probably the weaker of the three books, but it's a beautiful book, too. And if you're going to get into Vera Brittain at all, I'd recommend you read all three. And it also talks a lot of what was happening, the kind of the relief that happened at the end of World War I, and then realizing, one, that the League of Nations was not going to work, and then just, you know, it took only about 10 years before they realized that they were well on the way to World War II. And this talks about that period very well. I want to talk a little bit about Testament of Experience. This is a book that deals mainly with World War II and all things. And this one's fascinating because you get Vera Brittain lectured very, very widely. And I had a list here of what... she did 7 lecture tours of the U.S. and Canada between 1934 and 1959. She was in Seattle, lectured at the University of Washington and Washington State. In fact, she got the terrible case of the flu from some food poisoning in Pullman. She talks about that. she got to know some people in Minneapolis. And some people named Colby, and I would love sometime when I'm in Minneapolis to see if they or their descendants are still around, find out about that. And in fact, during World War II, sent her children to live with them. For most of World War II, her two children lived in Minneapolis with this Colby family. And one reason she sent her children away, well, you know, England was, that was terrible, with the Blitz and all that. But also, she and her husband were still working. Her husband was a political scientist, and he taught for a while at Cornell University in New York. And Vera Brittain's description of coming over to live as a faculty wife at Cornell is worth the book. she said it was going right back to being a 15-year-old in Buxton. That was her hometown, you know. After really having a fairly good life as a professional woman in England, she came to be a faculty wife at Cornell, still doing her. That was just so she could be with her husband for a while, and just got shoved right. She said she couldn't believe it. She's kind of, oh, this can't be true. But he was a political scientist. His name was George Catlin. And they were both very involved in, he in a sense is an observer and a reporter, as a political scientist was, in politics and in lecturing and doing all these things. And they were probably apart 4 months of every year. I mean, it was probably the first commuter marriage, and it was between, or not the first one probably, but between London and New York. And they spent a lot of, her husband traveled during World War II across the Atlantic 11 times, was torpedoed twice. And she was also doing traveling in Europe and came across the Atlantic, I believe, twice during World War II. And because they were so involved in that, that's why they sent their kids away to live in Minneapolis for a while. And but so this, but one, another thing interesting, that she gets more, because she travels to America all the time, it's really interesting to read her on the observations of the attitudes and things of our country regarding especially World War II. And you learn firsthand some of the things. We all know that the English were a bit hostile towards us until we entered the war, and we're sorry, you know, and we all apologize for not entering the war earlier and all this stuff afterwards. But it's really interesting to get her perspective from being right in the middle of it, and also knowing America quite well, having lived here and traveled here. Something just escaped me here. Another important thing that happens in this book is she makes the acquaintance, or talks about her acquaintance with Church of England canon named H.R.L. Shepherd, or Dick Shepherd, who founded the Peace Pledge Union at the end of World War I in England. She became very involved with him, and he was vicar at St. Martin's in the Field in London, and was a very, very prominent speaker for peace, and which in World War II was a highly unpopular item in England. And these people really did take a pacifist stand, and for a good reason. Many places, Vera Brittain questions whether or not in our world one can really be a pacifist, whether that is to be a total pacifist, if it's really a possible option. And so I'm just trying to point out that she's not just some idealist floating out there, but but points out that in order to make the point that the world is, that we're all humans together, and how necessary, especially as technology improved in terms of warfare, it is for us to acknowledge that common humanity and really work for peace. She said it, during World War II especially, it was very important that they take an extreme stand. Yeah. Or you were just waving or stretching or whatever. So that's another important thing she does in this book. It's getting... Okay, she also talks a lot about, well, I'll just read this little passage. Whatever might be possible for others, she talks about her own sort of decision to really join with these people in this peace movement. Whatever might be possible for others, integrity, as I understood it, would never permit me the periodic compromises of those who shouted for peace in peacetime and for war in wartime. Such moral gymnastics would involve a self-contempt even harder to live with than social ostracism. For what Dick Shepherd and his friends offered to their followers was not, in the last resort, a policy but a principle. The revolutionary principle put forward and still rejected by the majority of mankind in the Sermon on the Mount. It was a simple idea which derived its validity not from political calculation, but from the prophetic challenge of an inner compulsion. It was the belief for which Christ died in the ultimate transcendence of love over power. And it was, so you can see she's starting to work her way back, isn't she, from that, from her faith claims from at the end of World War I. She visited, one thing Vera Brittain did, she spent a lot of time visiting in Germany. After World War I, she went there to report as a journalist on the condition in Germany at the end of the war, and reports it with a great sensitivity. She did get into Germany just before the beginnings of World War I, and also reports that with a great horror and a great sensitivity. World War II, at the beginning of World War II. Yeah, and comparing it with what she saw after World War I, and a lot of things about why the German people should be get in this frenzy again to go through the same thing they just went through 15 years before, or 20 years before. She just couldn't understand that. Neither could anybody else, but I want to find a couple of other things. So we're running out of time very quickly. Yeah.
Did she talk specifically about her political position?
Yes, she does.
Regarding Marxism and socialism and all, yes, during World War II, or her husband?
Yes, she was. They were against it. they also saw, as did many people in Western Europe at that time, although there's all this infiltration, they saw what was happening in Russia and then after the war in Eastern Europe as horrifying as the ravages of war that had gone on in World War I and then in World War II.
Did she or very many British people get involved in the Spanish Civil War?
Yes, but that was, she didn't get involved in that personally, except for in, you know, reading about it and talking to people who were involved with it.
What were her feelings about that?
Sort of mixed. I mean, you know, that was a double, for her, that was a real double-edged sword. She didn't want either Marxism or fascism. What do you do? you get stuck in the middle, which was applied to a lot of people. But at that point, the threat of fascism was so much greater than communism, because we had to wait till the end of World War II to see the real impact of what Russian communism was going to do to Eastern Europe. that she, like most English people who were involved with that, sided on the side of the revolutionaries. And to put down okay, this is one thing I wonder. When her children started coming back from, they decided to bring their children back from Europe, and they had to go through Spain, they had to take a boat. Oh, it was terrible. They just like fly to Spain and then take a boat up the European coast to get to England. You know, she talks about just the terrible dredge she lived in, that her kids weren't going to make it. They were like 12 and 8 or something. You know, it's just, you know, horrifying. And it's a great story. But her daughter, who was the oldest one, Shirley, was given a, she said, the family relics of that period include a British Information Service pamphlet headed, "Since You Are Going to England," which was evidently given to Shirley as she left the United States. "You will find yourself," it began, "in a country that has been at war for more than 3 years. The war effort has changed the whole pattern of life to an extent that is hard to picture from the other side of the Atlantic. After some depressing comparisons between American and British food, clothing, tobacco, and toilet articles, the booklet continued bravely, in the material sense you will be giving up much, but you will also find we believe that the country is a happy place in which to live, for the sense of a common effort and the consciousness that every deprivation contributes a concrete part to the war effort, exhilarates people as it will exhilarate you. But, they go on, you may also find that many people are easily tired and sometimes therefore abrupt in their manner, because the cumulative pressure on nerves and physical and mental endurance during the last 2 years has been considerable. We know you will understand this and meet this fatigue with sympathy and patience. And she goes on to make the point that that second paragraph never would have been there in World War I. But it was in World War II, and partly that everybody was still alive in World War I was still alive in World War II. I want to find... This is sort of, I guess, her conversion experience. She was walking around in London in Whitehall on VE Day from World War I and was remembering Roland and Edward, that was her brother, and all the other people. And she says this while she was walking. And then came a strange experience, a confirmation of a long-growing certainty which even now is not instantaneous. Not for days could I begin to put into words the many months were needed for its full realization. Just how the change had occurred, I still cannot explain. I knew only that through humiliation had come an assurance which I had learned neither from deep grief nor from resounding success, and had skeptically repudiated after Winifred's death. Now, out of all the errors and confusions, had emerged a certainty so immense, the sad record of human fallibility dropped back into its appropriate, though significant, place. Walking dumbly and blindly up Whitehall at the end of the First War, I had felt no conviction of any divine principle, any Easter morning, any meeting again. Now, walking up Whitehall at the end of the Second, I became deeply aware that, in the past 5 years, my attitude had changed. I could not yet believe in the Easter morning and the meeting again. I did not expect to see Edward or Roland or Winifred in any future conceivable by human consciousness. But the existence of a benign rule, a spiritual imperative behind the anarchy and chaos of man's willful folly, I was now wholly assured. The superficial faith which the First War destroyed had been replaced by an adult conviction. Like the girl student in Glorious Morning, I knew that God lived, and that the sorrow and suffering in the world around me had come because men refused to obey his laws. The self-interested, provocative policies which had driven mankind to the edge of the abyss seemed to supply incontrovertible testimony that an opposite policy, the way of God, the road of the cross, would produce an opposite result. And she goes, there's a little more there too. She goes on. I want to read one last thing. We've got 2 minutes. Go quick. Vera Brittain continued this throughout her whole life. This book was written in 1957, she would have been in her early 60s, but she was always involved. Out of the Peace Pledge Union came a nuclear reactor was built just outside of London. I forget the name of the place. It's real. If you heard it, you will have heard of it before. It's about 10 miles from Trafalgar Square, which right now puts it pretty much in London. But at the end of World War II, at the beginning of the atomic age, huh? And I happened to be in England on Good Friday in 1972 and was at Trafalgar Square and saw all these people assembling with all these signs and stuff, and I asked somebody what was going on, and it was this yearly peace march that goes on from Trafalgar Square out to this place and back again. They walk 20 miles this one day, and they always get arrested. But it's an annual event, and one reason they go from Trafalgar Square, because right by Trafalgar Square is St. Martin's in the Field, where Dick Shepherd, the guy who started the Peace Pledge Union, was the vicar. So, and it all gets confused, and they do this. And I remember sitting there watching this, and then when I got into Vera Brittain, I found, she was dead then, but her daughter writes an introduction to Testament of Youth and talks about that her mother, even at the age, she was about 74 when she died, at age 70, was still being hauled off in a police wagon, you know, for being out there on Good Friday at these annual marches. And you would also be interested to know that her daughter, if you read the news and know anything about English politics and stuff like that, about a year ago there was a third party formed in England that broke away from the Labour Party because they were getting too liberal. And it's old-fashioned logging, in a sense, the old Liberal Party, so it's sort of weird. But I think they actually are calling themselves Social Democrats, too, I think. I'm not sure about that. But they have four leads, and there's a good chance that they will, because they're the middle-of-the-road party, that when Margaret Thatcher gets run out, if she does, when there's a new election in England, this party may be elected. It currently has four leaders. It's unclear which one will rise to the top of the party and so be prime minister if they're elected. But one of the four, the only woman of the four is Shirley Williams, who is the daughter of Vera Brittain. So that's an interesting facet, too. Just in closing, Belle's going to, oh, good, dinner's late. Belle hasn't rung yet, so. But the one thing that probably strikes me the most about these books, and I hope you read them and find this, too, is what happens when one really tries to live within the historical context one is given. One deals openly and realistically with what happens to one, you know, in terms of whatever it is, whether it's good success or terrible failure, whether it's great love and wonderful family and friends or terrific loss, whatever it happens to be. And that the kind of commitment one makes in intimate relationship is totally related to how one deals with society, and the commitments one makes in society completely transforms intimate relationship. And I just want to read you what her husband wrote to her once in a letter early in their marriage, 2 years after they were married, which I think is a wonderful statement of not only, this talks about married life, but not only about that kind of intimate relationship, but the kind of relationship we all have because we're all God's creatures and can be together as humans. He wrote this to her about... This is sort of, he's talking about what the result of their marriage should be or whatever, he says. It is not joint success. It is not children to be proud of. It is not the dear relation of bodies. It is not the new job of co-working with its bright hope and energy. It is not memories of blue skies and bees buzzing in the thyme. As we look back, it will be none of these, nor should it be as we look forward. It is that you are truly the sacrament of God to me, and that I try so to be to you. For in our two selves there is communication, companionship, thought, intimacy, love, and when we part, this flame dies down, which we have lit to light us through life together. And that whole thing about being a sacrament of God to me and I to you is the way Vera Brittain lived her life, not only with her husband and her children, but with everyone she met. So I hope you find some time to read Vera Brittain. Any other questions?